Hello, I'm calling
Mr. Rick Wagoner from General Motors. Mr. Rick Wagoner from General Motors, we need to speak with you about an important business matter. We need to talk about your account balance with the U.S. government. We value your business, Mr. Rick Wagoner from General Motors. Removal from the Dow Jones Industrial Companies can threaten your credit. If you want to make a payment, Mr. Rick Wagoner from General Motors, please press 1. If you are not available, please press 2. If you are ignoring this call, Mr. Rick Wagoner from General Motors, and are weeping silently in the dark, please stay on the line. Just stay on the line, Rick.
Debt collectors calling. Don't hang up. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, March 12th. I'm John Hockenberry from The Takeaway.
Yeah, that voice was oddly familiar, and I hope Mr. Rick Wagoner is, getting a little solace, maybe a cup
He's
of warm
listening.
Milk. Anyway,
listening.
I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora Udoji, who is spending some time with her new child. Coming up this hour, we all follow the Dow, but do we know how it works? Right after the headlines, we'll talk to someone from the Dow Jones company itself about how the index works, whether it matters. All this and more ahead, but first, these headlines.
And we also have some debt collectors who are going to talk to us as well. North Korea is officially marking its calendar for a launch. Pyongyang says it's just sending up a satellite, but U.S. and South Korean intelligence believes a long-range missile test is in the works. An Iraqi court says shoes are worth about a year and a half. The local TV journalist who threw both his shoes at President Bush now has 3 years in prison ahead of him. He faced up to 15.
Staying overseas, protests are in motion across Pakistan. The government is trying to stop them, deploying riot police to arrest political leaders. Now, these demonstrators want the current president to reinstate judges fired by the former leader, Pervez Musharraf. Here's opposition leader Nawaz Sharif.
You can't have democracy without an independent judiciary, without judges who are loyal to the state.
Several days of demonstrations are planned, and here in the U.S., we're going to get fresh data on the economy later this hour. New numbers on retail sales and jobless claims are on the way, and we're going to bring them to you live. Later today, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is going to testify in the Senate.
Madoff's in court, expected to plead guilty. New housing numbers show February foreclosures up 30% from the previous year. The Dow begins trading at 69.30. More about that in a moment. The S&P begins at 7.21. What is your American dream, and is it different from what your parents' dream was? The under 30 crowd we're asking today, what's your dream?
I'm 25 years old and calling from New York. My take on the American dream is to become actualized, but not just on the American stage, but also on the world stage. It's important for young people to have that worldview and bringing that back into America.
Dreamy or not, give us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. People under 30 today, tomorrow, entrepreneurs. You invented pocket fishermen or the hula hoop. We want to hear from those people tomorrow. Today, it's under 30. The under 30 crowd is like heating up the phones here. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora Udoji. We've been calling out all week to hear what different groups of people have to say about what the American dream is. This morning, we want to hear from you, the under 30 crowd.
Hi, my name is Olivia. I'm 26. I live on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And my American dream is pretty much the same, except we want to travel. We now know what's out there, so...
Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And what we've discovered here is that this is all about confidence. The notion of your American dream, positive or negative, really does relate to your confidence. And the entire economy at every level is seeking to know when we're going to get our confidence back, how we're going to get our confidence back, indeed, how to measure confidence. And it's not just today that this has been an issue. Think back to 1955. Here's President Dwight D. Eisenhower talking about the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which was at 400. Today it opens in the 6,000 somewhere, but it was at 400 back when this was said.
Now, I'm not saying that the stock market itself its rises and falls is necessarily an index of what we are going to happen in this country. But it does reflect that kind of confidence that we have tried in the past so hard to instill.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average, much reported, much followed, but is it a gauge of confidence in the U.S. economy? Technically, it's a list of 30 industrial, so-called blue-chip stocks. But is it a measure of broader confidence in the U.S. industrial economy and around the world? John Prestbo joins us. He's editor and executive director of the Dow Jones Indices and chairman of the Dow Jones Index Oversight Committee. John, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, John.
There are lots to talk about here, but first, Dwight D. Eisenhower said that the Dow Jones Industrial Average, or the stock market's rises and falls, are a measure, a sort of raw number measure of confidence in the economy. Do you buy that?
Yes, I do. I mean, it's a daily voting by investors on what they think is going to happen. And if they're buying, then they think that they're going to be able to sell later at a higher price. So that is a measure of confidence in profit growth, in economic growth. A vote of confidence.
Now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is an index of 30 industrial stocks, and many commentators, and someone who appears on this program a lot, David Leonard of the New York Times, says it's a very tiny snapshot of the broader stock market and maybe gets more emphasis than it deserves. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, from its very beginning, which is 113 years ago this year, it's been a shorthand indication of the stock market. That was its original purpose, and that continues to be its purpose, to take a small number of stocks, carefully selected, and use them as a proxy for what's going on in the market. This, of course, happened before there were computers. Now there are indexes with hundreds and thousands of components. So the 30, by comparison, looks very small. But the selection of those companies is very important, and the mix of those 30 really reflects what's going on in the economy. The statistical proof of that is that the Dow correlates very highly with the S&P 500. So they both tell the same story about the stock market. On any given day, one may be up and the other down, but over time, they correlate very, very highly.
John, I was just thinking about the literacy level that is required to look at these numbers. I remember when I was in high school, we had model stock market, and today Genentech was just bought by Roche, and that was actually one of the runaway stocks that someone in my high school class picked. But I, without digressing too much, I still feel like, even though I have to try to understand the stock market for my job, I'm constantly scrambling to figure out what exactly it means. And I know a lot of people have no idea what these numbers mean. Is it sufficient to constantly have these running in tickers, you know, on television sets, have these numbers in the newspaper and here on our radio show? Do you think that it actually can make people panic, I guess is what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. I think that there is such a thing as mass hysteria, and while we haven't reached that level yet, there certainly is such a thing as contagious pessimism or irrational despondency, shall we say.
I like that, irrational despondency. Sometimes you see that on CNBC when the market is really tanking and the whole network, some of these financial networks look more like a telethon for turning the indices around. Well, let's talk about some news. There have been moments when the Dow Jones Industrial Average and that list of 30 industrials has really undergone some tension as the economy shifts. I remember when Microsoft was brought into the Dow Jones Industrials, and a whole number of tech stocks really came into the Dow, and other traditional manufacturing stocks went out of the Dow, and that was a real symbol of the transformation of the U.S. economy from traditional manufacturing to tech. Now we have a different problem. or a different issue. A lot of traditional industrial stocks are way down. General Motors might even be pulled out of the 30 industrials, along with Citigroup. How is that decision being sort of evaluated there at Dow Jones?
Well, what we do, because we're running an index, not a portfolio, so it's not like we're making investment decisions. We're making representation decisions, if you will. So we look at a company like Citigroup or like General Motors and ask ourselves, do we think these companies are still representing the industries that they come from? And our judgment up until now, and maybe for the whole rest of the day, who knows, is that they do represent their industries. And they are indicative of what's happening in those industries. So that's what we look at. And, yes, we have been watching it closely. And, yes, we are watching each other's reaction to things. And when the time comes that we lose that confidence that these companies are indicative, out they go.
Well, you know, we just heard a little bit of President Eisenhower. President Kennedy also had his thoughts on the market.
For the first time in history, we have 70 million men and women at work. For the first time in history, factory earnings have exceeded $100 a week. And even the stock market has broken all records, though we only get credit when it goes down.
You know, one thing that strikes me about that statement was that you have two different indicators, or really three, the numbers of people employed, what they make, and then the stock market. You just argued that the stock market indices are representative of what's going on in the economy, but explain more about that, because employment numbers and what people make, are they really linked that closely to the market? I'm curious.
Well, they're linked, but they're not. It's not a finely calibrated connection. There was a statement by Paul Samuelson, the economist, a number of decades ago, he's actually now, when he said that the stock market has predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions.
And 9 of the last, that's great, yeah, that's great. I love that.
So the market is a much more volatile moving indicator than the economy itself.
And it's also a leading indicator, whereas employment is a lagging indicator. It sort of lags behind. So, and that's traditionally how that works statistically. Let me play 20 questions with you for a second, John. Any idea what the Dow was at when John Kennedy made that statement that the Farai just played?
Let's see, in the 60s, oh gosh, it had to be like 700 maybe.
He's good, man. 740, mm-hmm. 740.26 on 1-12-63, January 12th, 1963. So finally, I just want to nail you down here a little bit. Are you denying that Citigroup and GM are being considered to be removed from the 30 industrials, or is that a no comment?
Well, it's basically a no comment, but I can even shorten that to no, in the sense that they're not being considered for removal until and when they cease being representative.
Right. Okay.
And I know that's a subjective judgment, but there it is.
There it is. All right. Finally, if you're a company that gets onto the Dow Jones Industrial Average, do you get advantages because with all the exchange-traded funds, suddenly you get picked up in portfolios? Just a few seconds. I want to remind people of that.
Well, to some extent, yes, although because we have 30 stocks, all of which are in the S&P 500, for example, and larger indexes, they're already in a lot of funds. So there's some pickup, but not a lot. The benefit of being in the Dow is primarily prestige.
Prestige and a very highly watched number. John Prespo is editor and executive director of the Dow Jones Indexes and chairman of the Dow Jones Index Oversight Committee. Thanks so much for joining us, John, and we'll watch that confidence number all day today. The Dow opens in the 6,000s.
It's the truth. It's actual. Everything is satisfactual. Zip-a-dee-doo-dah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Farai Chidea. And all week long, various groups of people have been calling to tell us what their version of the American dream is at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Yesterday, immigrants were calling. Tomorrow, we want sort of small-scale entrepreneurs, inventors of like pocket fishermen, refrigerator magnets to make themselves rich. Today, we're hearing from the under 30 crowd. What's the American dream? Leela Briggs writes us, "I used to think the American dream was dead. Then I grew up. We didn't have a lot of money when I was young, and my father lost his job in his early 40s. After about a year or so, he scraped together what little money he had and started a business with several friends. The American dream was dead till she grew up." What's your thought at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org?
Hey, ain't nothing going on but the rent. That was Gwen Guthrie with a slightly peppy version of a very miserable story, bill collecting. Somebody's got to do it, and it takes a certain kind of voice to get people to comply. The good news for people who do it is that debt collection voice work is actually rising. We've got a couple people with us who do that. Donna Mack, a freelance voiceover artist, joins us from Providence, Rhode Island, in the studios of WRNI. And Jerry Burke works in-house as a voiceover artist at a company called CSG Systems. He's in Omaha, Nebraska. I'm going to get right to this. Donna, your voice is the one that people use to, you know, soften folks up. How do you approach your work? Give me an example of how you would approach, say, me if I was way behind in a bill.
Well, good morning, first of all, and thank you so much for having me on this morning.
All right, I'll pay. Fine.
You know, it's so funny because just a couple of years ago, they normally never would have chosen me or a voice like mine to do jobs like this. But I think, you know, considering the world has so shifted into this tough economic time, they're looking for somebody more like me who can be not only businesslike, but also understanding and compassionate to people's needs because, you know, like I said, things have so changed over the past couple of years.
Let's say that I haven't paid my Visa bill in 3 months. Just right. give me a line of what you might say to me.
I have some copy in front of me, as a matter of fact, right now. And it's amazing how the copy evolves as the situation evolves. You know, if you are somebody who has been delinquent for just a month or two or maybe three, you might hear something like, "This is a call from this specific company. We are a debt collector. This is an attempt to collect a debt, and any information obtained will be used for that purpose. Please call our office." And then the next call, perhaps the month later, might change a little bit. Instead of me saying something like, "Please return this call concerning an important business matter," I might say something like, "This is an urgent call. Please call us back immediately."
Hair standing up on the back of my neck here.
I can only get so mean, though, because, like I said, they hire me to be the compassionate, business-like voice.
So why do they hire you, Jerry?
They hire me to be mean. I'm the mean guy. I'm the heavy.
He comes after me.
That's right.
Jerry, can you give us a little taste of what you bring to the table?
Right. And just as Donna was saying, there are levels of doing this on my side as well. And there might be a wireless company that perhaps you haven't paid your bill, and the first message might be something like, "Please be advised, your account has exceeded its spending limit. You need to make a payment today to keep your account under its spending limit and in good standing." And perhaps if you're still being standoffish with your money, we might come back and say, "Your account is seriously past due in the amount of..." Your account is scheduled for suspension in the next 48 hours, and your outbound calls will be directed to our collections department.
I'm having like a combat flashback hearing this stuff. Is there some sort of like, you know, temptation to maybe play around with the script? For instance, if you're in the room with this person, you should know how much they owe our company. Listen to this unpaid balance. What a deadbeat. Do you ever want to play with the script and do something like that?
Well, I would personally love that, but actually all of these scripts that we go through, and I'm sure Donna goes through this as well, we have a series of events that happens between my company at Prairie and whoever our client is. They have some legal folks and some marketing folks that take a look at every word before it reaches me in the studio.
Donna, do you ever have, and I'm going to ask you this as well, Jerry, do you ever have regrets that you are working in a thriving business that is only thriving because people are on their knees?
You know, I really don't, because I am in a situation just like everybody else, you know. I still need to put food on the table. And, I have a daughter who's a year and a half away from college, so it's a big concern considering, you know, half my college money is now gone. Hopefully it'll be bouncing back pretty soon. And
coming right back.
Yeah, you know, and I do provide a service. This is just part of what I do. So,
Jerry, just quickly and mm-hmm. really, you know, sort of a yes or no. Do you ever have regrets about the work you do?
There are times. I have to tell you that in my past, I've received those calls. It's going back a few years, but I'm torn a bit because when I would receive those calls, it would be a live person, and that's difficult to deal with someone who's saying, "How are you?" And then they're saying, "We need your money."
Right.
I don't want to tell you how I am. You don't really care how I am. For me, it's actually easier to deal with an automated situation because you don't have that. They can be angry at a machine. That's fine. They can slam the phone.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that and appreciate your honesty. That was Jerry Burke from CSG Systems and Donna Mack, both voiceover artists for debt collection agencies. And now we have Femi Okay with the headlines.
Thank you very much, Farai. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. President Obama appears to have settled a pick to head the Food and Drug Administration. Dr. Margaret Hamburg is a former New York City health commissioner, and she's expected to be publicly announced soon. The FDA has been under fire lately for missing signals of several widespread tainted food outbreaks. A weekend dispute in the South China Sea will be a top discussion point when President Obama meets with China's top diplomat in Washington today. The two countries disagree over what happened between a U.S. naval mapping ship and several Chinese vessels. Beijing says the Navy ship was breaking the law. Washington says the ship was harassed by Chinese ships. In international news, 5 aid workers in Darfur have been kidnapped. Doctors Without Borders says that they were taken by gunpoint yesterday. The kidnappings come after Sudan ordered out several aid groups, including Doctors Without Borders. Sudan kicked out the humanitarian workers after the International Criminal Court put out an arrest for Sudan's president. And Doctors Without Borders has kept some workers in Darfur. The United Nations described the situation there as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We get around.
We have been calling out all week to different groups of Americans trying to find out what their American dream is. I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora Udoji. Now, this morning, we want to hear from you, the under 30 crowd.
My dream is to do nothing. I am 24 and I am sick of bills and a job ruining a life that I should be spending having fun and enjoying my family. So, nothing.
All right, I'm trying to win the Mega Millions too, but dude, that's a tough one to do nothing.
The economy can help him out probably. I'm
Anyway, I have a great deal of empathy for you, sir. But we want to know what other folks think about the new American dream. Let us know, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to the sound of the streets in Karachi, Pakistan this morning as suddenly the civilian government is threatened in a dispute between the government and lawyers and judges.
The issue is that the lawyers are still on the road. You know, the movement that drove President Musharraf, or General Musharraf as he was, out of power is now, you know, forced to do the same or is trying to do the same with President Zardari, because Zardari's become the same kind of despot that Musharraf was. A civilian government that hasn't really lived up to the promise that it made.
That's activist leader Yasser Latif Hamdani speaking to the BBC about the dispute between lawyers and the government, which threatens this fledgling civilian government in Pakistan. Joining us to explain what is at stake and whether this will turn out the way it did with President Musharraf, who you'll recall was forced from office because of this dispute, is Amiri Ghori, a Pakistani analyst formerly with the BBC, currently a writer on civilian and military relations in Pakistan. Amir, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. Good morning.
Let's explain, first of all, what the lawyers' dispute did to oust Pervez Musharraf, and then explain how Prime Minister Zardawi is actually in a similar situation now over former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif.
John, the issue is, unsettled for almost now 2 years. Lawyers came out on the street, to support the former Chief Justice of Pakistan, Chaudhry Iftikhar, when he was called into the office of the military dictator, Pervez Musharraf, and actually asked to leave his job. Now, in Pakistani, bureaucratic terms, a military general cannot throw out a chief justice, because in the pecking order, in the Pakistani pecking order, the chief justice comes on top of a military dictator. And for the last 2 years, this movement is going on when the lawyers actually asking for the reinstatement of that chief justice, and which was promised to him by, the late politician Benazir Bhutto, and also Nawaz Sharif, when they signed a Charter of Democracy in London almost 2 years ago. And the only issue is that because that chief justice was locking horns with the establishment at that time, President Pervez Musharraf, and because he knows that, the current president, Zardari, has come into power through a deal which was signed by, between Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto, and it was sanctioned by Washington and London, where the criminal charges against both these, personalities were dropped. They fear that if, Chaudhry Iftikhar comes back as the Chief Justice, he might open that case and basically declare these guys unfit to govern Pakistan. And that is why, while they have brought back almost 95% of the judges who were thrown out by Musharraf, almost 60 of them, these three judges were not brought back because they were not, towing the government line. And today, the issue stands there. President Zardari is not willing to, reinstate that judge. And that is why the lawyers are again on the Pakistani streets.
But why does President Asif Ali Zardari think that he can face this down? He's clearly in a much more vulnerable situation than Pervez Musharraf is if he couldn't survive. Why does Zardari think that he can survive this? I mean, we've already seen what's happened, and there's demonstrations today, and a march is planned, and there's all sorts of saber-rattling talk from the government. Where is Zardari's confidence come from?
John, this is the million-dollar question, and I am happy that you have actually asked it. People who know the politics of Pakistan, they know that only a year ago, Asif Zardari walked into the presidency of Pakistan completely unprepared, completely untrained, unwilling and unsure what he has to do, because he was not a politician. He was married to a politician. And sadly, that politician was blown away, killed on Pakistani street. And this guy was catapulted into her position. Now, when he came in, because he was unprepared, unsure, untrained, what he did, because he did not have an agenda, he was actually asked to follow what Musharraf was basically, you know, doing at that time. That means do not think inward, do not think about Pakistan, but think outward. You know, carry on talking about, you know, the war on terror, talking about Afghanistan, India, Kashmir, and not address, you know, the problems which Pakistan is facing.
So the very focus on the external issues, the ones you've identified, Kashmir, Afghanistan, the new Obama administration, has made Zardari vulnerable because he's neglected the domestic scene.
Definitely, because, and secondly, you know, he remains the most unpopular person in Pakistani politics, and I think what he's doing and what he's allowing to do by the establishment, I think he is basically, killing his own chances to remain a president.
All right, Amir, thanks so much for joining us. Formerly with the BBC, our guest Amir Ghouri is a Pakistani analyst with some sobering analysis of what's going on. Strife and unrest in the streets of Karachi and other cities in Pakistan. Again, it's the lawyers against the government. And here with more headlines is Femi Okay. Femi?
Thanks, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Two key economic numbers came out just a couple of minutes ago. Retail sales are down. That's been the trend for seven of the last 8 months, although the decline is less than analysts predicted. Consumer spending accounts for a majority of the nation's economy, so those numbers are being closely watched. There's some fresh job data which shows that 654,000 newly unemployed people filing for jobless benefits, and that's a little bit worse than analysts expected, and those are still on unemployment is hitting a record 5.3 million. The foreclosure watcher Realty Track reports that February foreclosures are up 30% from last year, and it said that nearly 300,000 homes received a foreclosure notice last month, and that's up 6% from January. President Obama wants to hear how states will use their share of the economic stimulus package. And the president, Vice President Biden, and leaders across the country are meeting at the White House today to discuss how the states want to use their dollars. And the summit is a chance for states to offer ideas and hear directly from the president's cabinet. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner faces some tough questioning before the Senate Budget Committee today, and he will defend the Obama administration's policies on taxes. A proposal to cut tax deductions for the nation's wealthiest is receiving criticism from both parties, and a plan to cut carbon emissions through a trading system will also be a hot topic. That's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Now, if I asked you to guess what two states have the highest percentage of households that are cell phone only, what would you answer? John, what would you answer?
Wow.
You read the materials, the prep materials. This is unfair.
I know it's not the coasts. I know it's not like New York and California.
No, it is Utah and Oklahoma.
Really?
Oklahoma. Now, they have at least 26% of their households that are cell phone only. Why is that? Well, luckily, Ivan Zatkovich is a telecommunications consultant here to tell us why. Why, Ivan?
Well, most interesting, it's counterintuitive, but people in Utah and Oklahoma have decided to forsake their other alternate services, such as landlines or cable TV phone service, for cell phone only, partially for economic reasons, but there's also several other phenomena occurring in the U.S. right now that's leading to that.
Give us an example.
One example is that we're looking at phone companies now investing in a significant new technology, 3G broadband, and we see the Obama presidency at looking to invest approximately $6 billion in wireless and broadband technology, mainly because what we have today is 90% penetration in the U.S. market for cell phone, meaning 90% of the people who will eventually buy cell phones in the United States have already purchased their cell phone. So the phone companies are competing within that segment for their subscribers. So they're mainly looking at a specific set of demographics today. Those demographics are folks between 18 and 35 years old. They are renters versus homeowners. They earn approximately $40K or less. And quite surprisingly, they're either Democrat or liberal-leaning, so the surveys say, and they're single. This demographic has decided that the area in which they live in, if they have sufficient cell phone coverage, are going to forsake their other phone lines in favor of cell phone only.
Well, you know, that I was wondering about cell phone coverage because I'm someone who has been lucky enough to drive across the country a couple times. And sometimes in New York City, where we are, you can barely get a signal. And there's vast parts of the country where you really can't get a signal. So Utah and Oklahoma are covered?
Well, Utah, if you look at the demographics in Utah, you see that half the population approximately lives in Salt Lake City. And Salt Lake City and the surrounding area actually have excellent cell phone coverage. The largest age group in Salt Lake City today is between 25 and 34, and the average income is in the 40Ks for those individuals. So that is actually the perfect target, and companies like AT&T and Verizon are looking at those demographics and saying, that is the group that we're going to target for cell phone-only coverage.
You know, it strikes me that one of the things that you said was really about, you know, the mobility of people, you know, the people who are renters and not owners. Do you think that with these economic times, more people will end up rolling over into cell only because, you know, their landline will literally be disconnected if they're going to have to leave their house?
Yeah, it's also an economic decision. I mean, if you only need one type of service and you have adequate coverage, people are going to opt for cell phone only. But naturally, the phone companies are going to try to leverage that into larger services that are being offered, like the higher broadband data coverage so that you can get wireless internet access, etc.
Well, Ivan, thanks so much. Ivan Zadkovich, telecommunications consultant.
Very well.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, calculating the challenge of calculating the financial value of an emotional loss. In just a moment, right after headlines from Femi Okeh, where that calculation is actually in open court today.
It absolutely is. It's my top story for this morning. The time just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Now, just about an hour ago, the disgraced financier Bernie Madoff arrived in federal courthouse in New York. News helicopters were covering his journey to the courthouse from the air, but down on the ground reporting for us, we have Arun Venugopal from WNYC Radio. Arun, just set the scene. What's happening out there?
Well, it's actually quite a remarkable scene here, Femi. You have the sun coming up over the low buildings of Chinatown where the courthouse is set. On one side of me, you have, of course, all the hordes of the media, all the still cameramen and the camera crews and whatnot. And on the other side of me, you have about 20 elderly and middle-aged Chinese-American women who are doing their Tai Chi with the accompanying music, so that'll always be the score for me. And everybody's just waiting for Bernie Madoff. He's gone in a while ago, and basically it'll be a while before anybody sees him come out because there are a lot of other victims who we're expecting to testify inside.
Now, Arun, you talked to some of the victims this morning. What do they have to say?
Yeah, you do have a few people who have come out here who have been surrounded by members of the media to sort of express what they're doing here. A couple of them are actually representing hundreds of victims themselves, hundreds of millions of dollars in investments which have disappeared. And a couple of things that you hear regularly are their complaints about the SEC. You know, all these years they've invested in them, they thought, well, the SEC has given what they considered a clean bill of health. So why were they, basically not aware of what was actually going on?
Right.
And because of that, they feel that if the SEC was, in a sense, complicit in this whole scheme by not really attending to the problem, then restitution should be accorded to these victims.
Right, Arun, we will hear more from those victims, I'm sure, today, as Bernie Madoff is in federal courthouse in New York. Arun Venugopal was reporting for us from WNYC Radio. And back to you, John and Farai.
Thanks so much, Femi. And we've been calling out all week to hear different groups of Americans and find out what their American dream is. This morning, we want to hear from younger folks. Here is a 24-year-old.
My take on the American dream, quite frankly, is that the American dream is dead. And right now, we are, as a country, attending its funeral.
Well, you can call to agree, disagree, give your own take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytakeofthetakeaway.org. If you're under 30, don't fake it. It's not a good look. We want to go even younger. We want to hear from people 20 and under. We know you're out there. Call us.
Joining us now is Ken Feinberg. He was once, you'll recall, nearly a household name in the tough days after the September 11th attacks here in New York and down in Washington. He was the special master of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. He's also author of the book, What is Life Worth? The Inside Story of the 9/11 Fund and its effort to compensate the victims of September 11th. Calculating emotional loss in financial terms. Mr. Feinberg, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, it occurred to us to ask you some questions as we watch outside the courtroom here, and the live cameras are already there. The Bernie Madoff hearing, he's going to plead guilty. He faces 150 years in jail, and there are so many victims of the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme. I know it's not comparable to the 9/11 situation at all, but, you know, they're talking about $65 billion in court. You had $7 billion to compensate the emotional distress of 5,300 victims of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and their families. And it occurs to me that this idea of pricing emotional loss is something that's not just about the Madoff scandal. It's really what we're going through in this entire economy. First of all, the challenges. What are the challenges of pricing this sort of emotional experience?
Well, it's very, very difficult. Now, with Madoff, the standard way you go about deciding worth for loss and compensating loss, first, you've got to marshal all of the assets. In the 9/11 fund, I had an unlimited budget. Congress just delegated to me the responsibility for compensating victims and said, pay whatever it costs out of the U.S. Treasury. We're not even going to appropriate funds for it. With Madoff, it's much, much different. The United States government is going to have to first discover what does the pot consist of. That'll be the first major task. And then decide whether to simply distribute the money to victims based on a percentage of what they invested through Madoff, or will there be an attempt to prioritize the claims? Nonprofit charities should get the money first,
right.
Homeless widows should get the money second, and only then will investors get what's left. That's unclear. The United States government will have to decide that as part of a criminal restitution fund, and that is the way that probably they'll go about deciding who gets what.
Well, I want to broaden this from Madoff, but in general, when you spoke with victims after 9/11, and I wonder if this is maybe true, we've heard it in some of the voices of the Madoff victims, and again, they're not strictly comparable, but is there a tension between wanting monetary compensation versus wanting simply to be heard?
Oh,
to have
absolutely.
Their, really, explain how that works.
Absolutely. What I learned with the 9/11 fund that I didn't fully appreciate beforehand is the desire of victims, through no fault of their own are they labeled victims, to have an opportunity to vent, not so much about money as about life's unfairness. And I found that what was enormously constructive in the ultimate success of the 9/11 Victim Fund was giving every single claimant the right to be heard. And we held hearings around the country and gave every individual claimant the right to be heard under oath with a transcript being made of the session. And that proved enormously constructive
wow.
in helping with the emotional healing.
You know, this seems to me a model, possibly, for scenes that I suspect are playing out all over the American economy as people face layoffs and exit interviews and trying to calculate their exit packages and severance and maybe figuring out what their unemployment insurance is going to be. Do you think this model extends into those domains?
Oh, it might very well. You have to understand the downside to it, first of all. Although I'm a big believer in the notion of giving people an opportunity to be heard, it does promote inefficiency. If you're trying to get money out as fast as possible to the victims, the more you have a formula, sort of just a formula for distribution, the easier it is to simply, at minimal cost, turn the money over to those who suffer. The minute you bog down that process by giving every single person the right to come in and vent to somebody, that will inevitably delay distribution. But right. I agree, there's a tremendous tension there, and with the 9/11 fund, those hearings proved to be absolutely essential to the program.
Ken, this is Farai. Excuse me. when I think about your tension between time and efficiency, I'm wondering in general, what do you think happens at a time like this where there are going to be so many cases of fraud exposed, and what's the capacity? Who's going to do the work of listening, I guess, is part of it?
Well, that's a very good question. Now, with a criminal restitution fund, post-Madoff, you may have the United States appoint a special master, similar to what I did, to marshal the assets and invite victims of the fraud to appear and be heard voluntarily if they want. The other source you mentioned, the other source of an opportunity to be heard and to vent will be in the civil litigation. Undoubtedly, there's going to be major, major protracted civil litigation against Madoff's estate and those who might have allegedly aided and abetted him. And people will be, for the next 10 years, it will be a lawyer's dream as people litigate, have their testimony deposed, testify in hearings, and vent for years to come.
Thanks so much, Ken Feinberg, for eloquently laying out what the tensions are there and throughout the economy. Ken Feinberg, of course, the former special master of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund.
And we're talking all this week about the new American dream. What does it mean to you? This morning, we're checking in with the under 30 crowd.
My American dream is actually just to live and be and try to enjoy life as much as possible, regardless of anything else.
Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
There is such a thing as mass hysteria, and while we haven't reached that level yet, there certainly is such a thing as contagious pessimism or irrational despondency.
We're trying to avoid that right here at The Takeaway. That was John Prestbo, editor and executive director of the Dow Jones Indexes and chairman of the Dow Jones Index Oversight Committee. I'm Farai Chidea.
And the Dow looks poised to bounce a little downwardly this morning. I'm John Hockenberry. Of course, this is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Hey, neighbor, let's play.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine?
Oh, we all eventually learn how that whimsical, protected world of kid play ends much too early in life.
I ain't playing with him. I ain't playing with him. I ain't playing with him. I ain't playing with him.
But if you truly ain't playing as an adult, it can have enormous consequences for the brain. Our need for play ranks right up there with food and water. Can you say brain development?
Let's have some play ourselves. Some make-believe kind of play. And let's make believe that the king and queen are back from looking for Prince Tuesday.
Playtime for Prince Thursday on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Playtime, good morning. It's Thursday, March 12th. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora Udoji, who's on leave with her new baby. Coming up this hour, you may know who watches the watchmen, but who regulates the regulators? We're going to talk about what's being done to prevent more big-ticket financial frauds. Plus, new jobless numbers are out today. We've got them. Behind those numbers are real people with families, with bills to pay, houses. You're going to meet some of them in a moment, and all this and much more ahead. But first, the headlines.
Two key economic indicators are out in the last hour. Retail sales down slightly. That's been the trend for 7 of the last 8 months. The decline is less than analysts predicted, though. Consumer spending makes up a majority of the nation's economy. Fresh job data shows 654,000 newly unemployed people filing for jobless benefits in the previous week, a record 5.3 million total are continuing to file jobless claims.
And not even everyone who's unemployed is even filing. So when you lose your job, you start to worry about paying your mortgage. An alarming new study shows February foreclosures up 30% from the previous year. Rick Sharga of RealtyTrack sees layoffs behind the home numbers.
What we're seeing for the first time are states like Idaho, Oregon, and Illinois in the top 10. And it may be that what we're starting to experience is the first wave of unemployment-driven foreclosures rather than lending-driven foreclosures.
Sharga's firm did that latest study. And investor Bernard Madoff is in court now. He's expected to plead guilty to multiple felony charges. Attorney Jerry Reisman represents several of Madoff's victims, and here's what he wants to hear today.
I'd want to know when he started this. I want to know who gave him the idea to do it and why he did it. And why he took money from his friends, his close friends.
Now Madoff faces a sentence of up to 150 years for 11 felonies.
Quickly overseas, 3 years in prison for that Iraqi journalist who threw shoes at President Bush back in December. Mass protest underway in Pakistan, even as the government tries to block it. Instability over a dispute over lawyers. The S&P and the Dow barely edged up yesterday. The Dow begins trading at 69.30. And we've been asking you all week, different groups in America, what is the American dream? And the under 30 crowd, what do they have to say?
My name's Emily, calling from Detroit, Michigan, and my American dream is just to stay home with my daughter. Why does every woman have to be a working mom?
What is your new American dream here on The Takeaway? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora Udoji. We have been calling out all week to hear from different groups of Americans trying to find out what the heck the American dream is for themselves. This morning, we want to hear folks who are under 30. What is your new American dream?
My American dream is just to do as well as my parents did. I'm 24. When they were my age, they already owned a house and had a kid. I don't think I'll be able to afford any of that stuff until I'm at least 35, probably.
Give us a ring, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Every one of those voices puts a face on the economic statistics
Absolutely.
We talk about every day.
Absolutely.
It's great, great stuff. So we want to take some more economic numbers apart on this show and to show you the human faces behind the numbers. If you looked at the unemployment figures that came out for the month of February, an 8.1% unemployment rate, but in certain states the jump was extreme and severe. South Carolina and Oregon, two states that jumped more than 1% in 1 month alone. Joining us is Ethan Lindsay, reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting in Bend, Oregon. Ethan, thanks for being with us.
Hello there.
And Noelle Phillips is a economic and business reporter for the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina. Noelle, thanks for being with us as well.
Good morning.
First of all, Ethan, how do people in Oregon respond to the, first of all, the scale of unemployment, which is big, but the rapidness with which unemployment has really, worked its way throughout the state economy?
Yeah, the unemployment rate's almost 10% here, and I think everyone expects that the next numbers that come out are going to show it in double digits. That's the highest it's been in 25 years, and it's just a year ago, the unemployment rate was at 5.3%. But I think most people sort of look at it as the numbers finally catching up with the reality on the ground. It was a lot of industries that maybe were hanging on to see if things would turn around, and then when it didn't look like that was going to happen, the axe, fell.
And, of course, the timber industry is really big in the Pacific Northwest. Everybody understands the link between timber and housing starts, and so it was simply a matter of time. What other industries besides timber are really affected here? We certainly know Oregon as being the land of Nikes and a certain kind of high-tech businesses as well.
Yeah, I think that, Intel is one of the bigger employers, and the state had, after the timber industry really slowed down in the 80s and the 90s over the, spotted owl fights and all of that, the area really tried to switch to the Silicon Forest, but when the dot-com, bust happened, they sort of lost that. So manufacturing still is very strong here. One sector that's very strong in manufacturing is RV manufacturing, motorhome makers dot the landscape from Eugene to the east part of the state. And obviously with the credit crunch and a slowdown in consumer spending and consumer confidence, RVs aren't being bought and aren't being made.
Noel, what's going on in North Carolina? Your unemployment rate is second only to Michigan, and I'm wondering what industries that affects.
In South Carolina, it's spread to every sector. There's in the latest numbers that came out, there's not an employment sector that there's one. Information gained 100 jobs, but that's within the margin of error, so we don't even know if that's a gain. Everything else, healthcare, leisure and hospitality, construction, manufacturing, retail, everything lost jobs.
Noel, I was in South Carolina for the presidential primary, and there was a lot of talk about education and about how underfunded, the corridor of shame, I believe is what they call
right.
it, the strip of schools, underperforming schools. How is education linked to the job losses, if at all?
Yeah, it's a lot of the industries, I hear that when industries look at a state and where they want to locate, the quality of the labor force is now the number one concern. You used to hear about incentives and having to lure with tax breaks, and now a lot of the economic recruiters, economic developers say it's education and qualified workforce, and that a lot of people say that has hurt South Carolina.
Oh, wow. Noel, that has to be hugely demoralizing. I mean, of course, here's a state which has already suffered from the decline and the evaporation of the textile industry. And I would have thought that over the last 10, 20 years, that a sense that maybe they've diversified in South Carolina enough to avoid this kind of a downturn, but the numbers say otherwise.
Yeah, South Carolina had a huge textile industry. And that started going away kind of in the 70s in the recession, but we still had a lot of those jobs. And then South Carolina's unemployment rate was higher than the national average until the 2001 recession. And then in 2003, when the rest of the country started doing better, we didn't, and that was textile jobs leaving. And when you graduated from high school in some of these rural communities in the 70s, 80s, you went to work in a textile mill and didn't go to college, and you've worked there now for 20 years, and it's closed. I went to a sock factory in Whitmire, South Carolina, last month. 570 jobs are gone. The sock factory closed. And there were people who'd worked there for 20 years. They're in their 40s. They don't have a high school education. All they've done is sew socks. So now they're going to be eligible for some money to retrain and learn new skills, though, because those jobs are going offshore.
Even what about in Oregon? You have obviously high tech. You have the tourism, people going up and down the coast. Especially, we've talked about RVs and logging and timber. How would you how would you assess the skills of the workforce in Oregon, and what kind of possibility? Like, you know, you're not someone who is selling the state, but if someone were to sell the state and its advantages in terms of locating a business there, what would be some of the selling points for Oregon?
Well, Fry, that's a good question. I think we actually, Oregon, I think people don't realize, has a lesser educated workforce, similar to, it sounds like, West Virginia, maybe not on the same level, but that's something that the state has to overcome. But Washington and Oregon, the Northwest, because of, I think, their connections to whether it's the Pacific Rim, California, exports, manufacturing, that's a real strong sector that people are looking for. And then also there's a lot of investments in, I'm sure, the rest of the country as well, but in Portland and Oregon, green technologies and green investments.
And that's certainly something in the community that you're in right now. I mean, I actually used to live in Oregon years ago. I went to University of Oregon for a little while and have been in Bend. I mean, people's sense of wealth in the Pacific Northwest relates very directly to the property that they own, if they are property owners. I'm wondering what that's done, the decline in property values has done in the town of Bend.
Bend's really interesting because I think so many people moved here over the last 15 years. The population, in fact, tripled from about 20,000 to 80,000, quadrupled from 20,000 to 80,000, excuse me, that there were all these new homeowners. So people thought the housing slowdown was really going to hurt. But that didn't hurt as much as the stock market collapse did, which took away a lot of the 401ks and investment income that a lot of the early retirees and baby boomers had expected to be living on. And now you have a whole new added, you know, unemployed workforce that's trying to find jobs in this part of the country.
Well, that is quite a dilemma. Now, Noah Phillips, you have an added dilemma there in Columbia, South Carolina, and that is your governor seems to be hesitant about spending federal stimulus money, which at least politically sounds like it's going to have an impact on unemployment insurance. How is that playing in Columbia?
Well, actually, Governor Mark Sanford has accepted some stimulus money. One of the earliest things that came out in the package was states could sign up and be eligible for this program that would add an extra $25 a week to unemployment checks. And there were no strings attached for states. They would just get it. And every governor in the union agreed to take it, including Governor Sanford. So, yes, we have gotten some stimulus money, and it's going to kick in for the unemployed probably next week, where they'll see an extra $25 a week in their paycheck.
But is there any political fallout for the governor for at least pretending or seeming to stand in the way, even if he eventually did accept the money?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, there's loopholes in the legislation that South Carolina will be able to get around Governor Sanford and get the money anyway.
Right. Ethan,
Jim Clyburn, who's, you know, the majority whip in the
right.
House, made sure that happened.
Ethan, before we go, stimulus, any signs of it out there in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, John, we just got some Forest Service money to, you know, create jobs, thinning the forests. I think that's one thing people are really reliant on. And as I said before, green jobs, green investments is something the state's really, really looking forward for.
Literally the neck of the woods goes right back to the New Deal, forestry thinning. Those were definitely part of FDR's program back during the Depression. Ethan Lindsay, a reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting in Bend, Oregon, and Noel Phillips, economic and business reporter for the state newspaper. Thanks so much for getting us outside of Washington and Wall Street on these dismal economic numbers.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
For the kids in America, for the kids.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Farai Chidea. And hey, kids, what's your new American dream?
All I really want in the world is to be happy. That's it. I just want to be happy. To me, that would be the American dream.
We're hearing from the under 30 crowd on our question, what is the new American dream? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Hey, kids.
Well, thanks. And catching up on the Bernie Madoff story, he's expected to plead guilty today on multiple charges of fraud. He could spend the rest of his life behind bars. His $63 billion or so Ponzi scheme may well be the largest case of investor fraud ever committed. In a public speech this week, the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke gave his take on how to prevent another Madoff.
And finally, we should consider whether the creation of an authority specifically charged with monitoring and addressing systemic risks would help protect the system from financial crises like the one we are currently experiencing.
To give us some more perspective, we've got Leonard Orland. He's an Oliver Ellsworth professor of law at the University of Connecticut and a white-collar criminal specialist. First of all, what does a white-collar criminal specialist do?
I consult, I write, I deal with, for the past 10 years, corporate and white-collar crime. That is, people who violate the criminal law in order to make money.
Now, is there any parallel to the Madoff case? I mean, is this really something that kind of breaks all records for white-collar crime, or are there other cases that we may not have paid attention to that are very similar?
I think it breaks all records on two scores. First, it's longevity, decades. Ponzi's don't usually last that long. And second, the sheer amount of the money, $60-plus billion, both are unprecedented.
I want to go to what Chairman Bernanke said. He said, we should consider the creation of an authority that would help protect the system from financial crisis. Now, that sounds like a good idea, but what would such an authority look like? I mean, there wasn't a lot of meat on those bones.
I have a slightly different approach to reform, not dissimilar from the chairman's. The problem has been lax enforcement by the Securities and Exchange Commission. There's overlapping enforcement between the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission, but by all standards, the Department of Justice has been far more aggressive, far more effective, has far more tools, such as grand jury investigations. I think that the Obama administration ought to think seriously about shifting all securities, criminal, investigative, and enforcement operations to the Department of Justice and have the SEC have a diminished role in its enforcement function.
Well, that's interesting because we certainly saw Bernie Madoff taking advantage of the fact that the SEC has a set of rules for investment banks, a different set of rules or no rules for hedge funds, and that he could basically move paper from one office to the other and elude regulators who, even though, as you say, weren't very much in the vigilance department that when it came to his operation to begin with.
Yeah, I can recall being on programs and panels after Enron with senior SEC officials, and they candidly acknowledged that they did not then have the ability to examine the validity of the financial numbers that were being tossed at them. Federal prosecutors can do that in a grand jury context in a way that SEC enforcers cannot.
Only if there's law, though.
Well, you've got to distinguish between substantive law violations, we have plenty of those, and enforcement mechanisms. I don't think it's hard to create a statute that shifts the enforcement function from the SEC to exclusively the Justice Department.
Earlier in the show, we were talking about how you value life and how you return assets to people who need them or deserve them in light of 9/11 and some of the listening that went on there in order to come up with financial formulas. Really, who will be prioritized, do you think, in a case like this? Who will get to the front of the line in order to get restitution? Is there any kind of formula for dealing with that?
No, there isn't. And my view, I'm very skeptical about the ability of defrauded Madoff investors to be made whole in any realistic degree. By and large, billions are going to be lost, and I think it's unlikely that more than hundreds of millions will ultimately result in restitution.
Well, thanks for that. And that's Leonard Orlin, an Oliver Ellsworth professor of law at the University of Connecticut and a white-collar criminal specialist. Now we have Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you, Farai. The time is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. It's a developing story from overseas. We reported on this yesterday. A teenager who killed 15 at a German high school near Stuttgart in southern Germany yesterday warned of his attack in an internet chat room. German investigators say that the 17-year-old gunman told others in a chat room he was sick of life and wrote, "You will hear from me tomorrow." The next day, the teen killed students and teachers at his former school before eventually killing himself. The Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush last year has been sentenced to 3 years in jail. The man, Muntada al-Zaidi, was found guilty by the court in Baghdad of assaulting a foreign head of state.
Can't do that.
And his lawyers say they will appeal.
Yeah.
So maybe this story isn't over quite yet.
Can't assault a foreign head of state.
Back here.
Not
in,
permissible. No, no.
We're suddenly in stereo. That's weird. Back here in the United States, an alarming new housing study shows that February foreclosures are up 30% from the previous year. And this news comes in from Realty Track. And we have some just-released numbers that show retail sales are down a little bit, and that's been the trend for the last 7 of 8 months, and the latest decline is less than analysts predicted. Consumer spending accounts for a majority of the nation's economy, so those numbers are being very closely watched. Also, some fresh job data out in the last hour, which show that 654,000 newly unemployed people are filing for jobless benefits. And that is a record. At the moment, we have 5.3 million people who are staying on unemployment, and that is a record. That's the highest since we kept track of those numbers back in 1967. And it's not just the little guy who's been lost in the big global financial crisis. Forbes is reporting that the world's richest men are much poorer. A new report shows that billionaires have lost more than a fifth of their wealth in a year, and hundreds of billionaires have now been downgraded to just being multi-millionaire status, and now we only have 793 billionaires in the world. Bill Gates is top of that list.
Only 793 billionaires?
Mm-hmm.
I'm so embarrassed. That's outrageous. Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora, who is on maternity leave. And we've been calling out all week to different groups of Americans to find out what their American dream is.
I think my American dream is the same as my father's American dream and the same as my grandfather's American dream. It's to work hard, do well, support your family, and just live the American dream.
How you doing, guys? My name is Louis. I'm calling from New York. I'm 29. My American dream probably will be not to get my property foreclosed, and probably is not a dream anymore. They have made it into a fantasy.
Wow, someone who's on the line right now on the hook. And this morning we want to hear from you, people under 30. What is your American dream? How are things going? Tell us your thoughts, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
So I'm looking at Dr. Stuart Brown's book, Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul. And you ever had a pet kitty, a little cat or played around with a little baby cat?
I didn't have one, but, you know, I can drag a string.
Sure. And the cat, of course, the young kitty loves to play and play and play. But as cats get older, they get kind of set in their ways, and they seem to lose this impulse to play. And listen to this line from We Are Built for Play, the chapter in Dr. Stuart Brown's book. If we stop playing, okay, we share the fate of all animals that grow out of play. Our behavior becomes fixed. We suddenly are not interested in new and different things. We find fewer opportunities to take pleasure in the world around us. Think about that. We are built for play. With all our creative energy and propensity for leisure and wanting to body surf or windsurf, we are built for play. Dr. Stuart Brown, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Your brain needs to play, and you know, we work too much on this program, and I think people are thinking way too much about work in this economic environment. But play is something not only are we built for, but we really need, like a nutrition.
Absolutely.
What is the evidence that play for adults is a really important generator of creative impulses, of ideas, of even relieving stress?
Well, the evidence is broad. It starts objectively by watching animals at play and seeing what it does for them, which improves their performance, immune system, their capacity to remember things. And if you follow that through to the human system, those same benefits accrue to us, particularly in fertile imagination, in a sense of optimism, the capacity to persevere and to do things that you enjoy. Are all byproducts of play. And if you then hook somebody up to a brain imaging machine, you'll find out that when they're at play, the brain lights up more from that than virtually anything else we can do.
And this is the kind of research that you do as the founder of the National Institute for Play, and you're trained originally as a psychiatrist. Tell me how this goes way beyond simply the stop and smell the roses advice that, you know, mom gave you maybe a long time ago.
Well, perhaps a way of bringing it across to readers would be imagine your life without play. No books, no humor, no pub conversations, no movies, no spectator sports, no laughing with your kids or grandkids. And you begin to see what play, the contributions of play to life itself. And then if you look more closely and begin to try and measure some of those things, that's tougher. But you can do that in the right setting, and you find that it is the fertilizer of the brain.
You know, one of the things that I loved about this book, and I really did love it, was the way that you're able to take really complex ideas and break them down into simple chunks, like the way that babies play in the womb, apparently. Tell me about that.
Well, I don't know that we know a whole lot, but if you watch a baby in the womb with ultrasound, for example, and you see their movements are rhythmic and curvilinear. And the fundamental play movements that we see when we're out of the womb are not straightforward and aggressive. They are curvilinear. Also, you can...
What does that word mean?
It means curved. It means if you see an animal predator, for example, going for its kill, it will be straightforward and fixed. Whereas if you see a playful animal, they'll be galloping and going back and forth, and that's
chasing
what I
its
would
tail,
say.
Chasing dog chasing
tail.
The
that's,
tail. Yeah.
That's right. That's more curvilinear. So you see not only these babies in utero moving curvilinearly, but often you'll see a smile. On the baby's face.
We've shared stages at design conferences and things where, very serious business people in the audience are looking at play as a whole strategy for their business of keeping their people creative and keeping morale up in the company. How much do people rely on your work to really get ideas for how to improve their, kind of quality of life in the office?
Well, I think it varies a lot, John. Yeah. Some companies, you mention play, and you'll be out the door, and they'll say, "Listen, we got to stick our nose to grindstone and keep things going." But an open administrative company that likes to play, like Google or the IDEO company, incorporate play completely into their planning, into innovation, and into how it really nourishes that company's future and gives them fresh product.
Now, I had a chessboard open in my office when I worked at NBC, and I actually got talked to by HR. The GE people sent him in. But could I have made the argument to them, hey, I'm making my brain, you know, better for you here at NBC.
You surely could have, but the farther we get into neuroscience, the more they would be listening to you now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In these economic times, what is the importance of play, do you think?
Well, imagine here we are, fearful, economic collapse. It's the elephant in everybody's room. Am I going to lose my job? If we get fear-based and we don't access our playful imagination, we're not going to come up with solutions which have to be fresh. We're in a brand new set of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And far as I'm concerned, the very fact that we humans have play as a part of our nature is to help us adapt to the unexpected and help us be flexible for the future.
So turn that elephant in the room into a stuffed elephant. A great advice from Dr. Stuart Brown, psychiatrist and founder of the National Institute for Play and co-author of the book Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul. Femi Oke is here with some more headlines.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. In Washington, D.C., President Barack Obama hosts China's top diplomat at the White House this afternoon. This comes amid new military tension between the two countries. Beijing says that a U.S. Navy ship in the South China Sea was there illegally. Washington says it was harassed by Chinese ships in protected international waters. And the president will also discuss the economy. A new report shows that the nation's high school graduation rates are flat nationally. Three-quarters are earning their cap and gown, roughly the same as 4 years before. And the Johns Hopkins University study found positive trends at the state level, and a dozen states made strong gains in graduation rates. Cutting the dropout rate is a lead goal of President Obama's new education effort. And internationally, Pakistani police are arresting protest leaders and stopping hundreds of marchers from leaving Karachi. That's Pakistan's largest city. Protests are going on around the country for the reinstatement of judges sacked by former leader Pervez Musharraf. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
It is. Hey, neighbor.
Won't you be mine?
We have Dr. Stuart Brown still with us, psychiatrist, founder of the National Institute for Play. And we originally thought in this segment we'd do an interview on, you know, billionaires losing billions in the economic crisis or some sort of news-related story. But we thought, why just talk about play when we could actually play, you know? I mean, I went into my kids' room this morning as I left at about 3 in the morning. I just looked at their room to see what it looked like. And there was my son's little dragon sets, you know, sort of sitting out. And my daughter, a 7-year-old daughter, had her little doggies or little stuffed animal doggies hugged around her. And then in the middle of the room was two cups and a string. They were playing the telephone game. So I thought we'd do that. I got a cup and a string.
Hey, Fry. Hi, how you doing?
I'm good, John.
You got to put it on your ear.
Hey, Fry. How you doing?
It's hard to put this on my ear with the headphones.
Hi, John. What's going on?
These are great. Hey.
So we should just play. Let's just play. I got a paper airplane for you, Stuart.
Hey.
just threw a paper airplane. Oh. Nailed me.
Hey, that was pretty good.
And I've got cards. Uno cards. Did anyone play Uno?
Yeah, Uno's a great game. We've got a bingo game here, which we actually used. This is like a bingo game, you know. But what did I do? 073. You
scored it.
You got it. All right. Yay, Stuart wins. So how do you decide in the middle of the day to just play? What do? Pick up a ball?
It depends on where I am, John. If I've got a physical opening, I may just dance a jig. If I'm in a enclosed space, I have a wonderful imagination.
Oh, yeah.
do you consider that play just to basically, play in your imagination. Well, let me phrase it from
your book. You're going to get a paper airplane if you don't get that question out.
I know. No, I'm switching my question in mid-direction. I'm playing with my question. You have all these different types of play that you talk about, the kinesthetic play, which is the physical play. You talk about all these different ways that we play. I mean, does it matter how we play, if we play?
No, if you get yourself into a state of play, which is kind of a pleasurable, do it for its own sake, voluntary state, it can be anything from highly physical to totally imaginative.
Here's airplane number two.
Here it comes. Whoa, good shot, John.
I can feel my brain getting better.
It is. I can see it.
You know, I have to describe the scene in here. We're filming this on a little flip cam, so you'll be when you go to the website, you'll see how goofy we are.
Play with us. Come and play with us, Danny.
Radio is a form of play, don't you think, John?
Yes. Oh, I think so.
This is absolutely ridiculous.
They're playing in the control room.
Oh my goodness. Oh.
Hey, Fry, come in over. Fry, come in over.
Roger.
These work better, actually, than our satellite links. That's great. You know, we in the news, I think, are constantly driving forward, and I think maybe we're cynical sometimes, and we have fun being cynical. But I think this just couple of minutes has really taught me that just basically relaxing, stepping out of it, does have value.
Well, look at our own mood. It raised mine just to get going here a little bit this early in the morning, and I think it does it for everybody.
Enjoy the rest of your day, neighbor.
Thank you.
Dr. Stuart Brown, founder of the National Institute of Play and co-author of the new book, Play, How It Shapes the Brain. Man, I got a good shape. My brain's in a good shape right now.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. More American Dreaming right after headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks very much, John. The time just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Bernie Madoff is in the New York courthouse where he's expected to plead guilty to 11 felony charges. The judge says there is no plea deal to give Madoff a lighter sentence. Unemployment lines are growing longer. The Labour Department announced this morning new jobless claims have risen to 654,000, while continuing claims set a record of 5.3 million. And at the same time, retail sales have fallen for the seventh time in the past 8 months. This morning at the White House, President Barack Obama will meet with state officials who are working out how to spend their share of the stimulus bill money. The White House says the summit is a chance for states to offer ideas and hear directly from cabinet secretaries. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi. All week, we've been hearing from different groups of Americans, finding out what their American dream is. We're asking the under 30 crowd to let us know what their American dream is. And Miko Mercer, who's 23, writes, I feel that my generation is fraught with indecisiveness, impatience, indifference about the American dream. We were raised to believe we could do anything and have boundless possibilities. Most of my friends don't know what their dreams are yet, especially with the current downturn. We're confused and perhaps disappointed about what we can dream. My dream right now is just to figure out what my dream is. The execution on that dream can only come afterwards. Thoughtful comments there. Send us yours at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And America, it's time to wake up.
I have a dream.
What's happening to us?
The American dream.
A better way of life.
The great American
dream.
Well, tell me you don't know what that is. Okay, well, it's actually quite hard if you don't.
My piece of the American dream.
What everybody wants as they start out.
Securing your portion of the American dream.
In my American dream, the people do make a difference.
Well, 40 acres and a mule, a McMansion, whatever your dream is, do you have it? Could you get it? Do you want it? We're going to take a look at immigrants, basically. Our friend Gustavo Arellano joins us from KUCI in Irvine, California. Gustavo, it's great to talk to you again. You're writing, of course, this column, Ask a Mexican, which is wildly popular. And then you also have this op-ed in the LA Times opinion page. Tell me what's going on and what you're thinking about.
What I'm thinking about was it's a birthday party for my cousin's daughter where all of us of my generation, my cousins, my friends, us, the children of Mexican immigrants, we're sitting around and just laughing at how our parents, which other Americans would call dumb Mexicans because they don't know how to speak English. But nevertheless, these dumb Mexicans all have their nice little three-bedroom, two-bath, one-swimming-pool American dream. And us assimilated kids with master's degrees could barely afford apartments or still share bunk beds with our 15-year-old brothers.
Are you buying too many lattes in Echo Park, Los Angeles? I mean, I have a lot of friends who are kids of immigrants, and although I consider myself very much American born and raised, my father was an immigrant. And, you know, there's definitely this collective shrug that immigrant parents give when they see their wastrel children, you know, going out and, you know, buying, you know, cute jeans and this and that instead of scraping and saving and, you know, living five to a bedroom. I mean, are we just not tough enough?
My parents, specifically my dad, has no sympathy for me whatsoever.
Does he call you a wastrel?
Not a wastrel. He calls me other words in Spanish that I can't say on the air, even though your audience probably doesn't know them anyway. Definitely not the FCC. But what he does tell me is that even though he had a fourth grade education, he dropped out of school in Mexico so he could take care of cows. Even though with that, he himself has boasted that I could get a job right now and, you know, anything within a week. He actually recently just got laid off as a truck driver. Oh. I know it's unfortunate, but I expect within the week for him, if not to have 15 job opportunities to make a job for himself because
right.
He's resourceful. That's the ironic thing, I think, about my generation of immigrants, specifically Mexican immigrants, is that even though we have a much better situation we used to have a much better situation to improve in this country, unlike my parents, at this point in American history, we're stuck in limbo. We're stuck in limbo with our nice degrees and our Camrys and our, you know, and our meager savings. And I don't drink lattes myself. I drink Jarritos, which is a very sweet Mexican soda. So I wasted all my money on sodas.
All right.
What
can I say? Well, Gustavo, you know, it's great that you've done this op-ed. And, of course, your impulse is to be a writer and to, you know, talk to the people out there about the things that are close to your heart. But maybe what's going on now is you need to be talking to the old man about what to do now. Take his advice, finally, for a change.
Well, if I paid attention, though, to my mom and my dad, a couple of years ago, when everybody was flipping houses, they said, you have to buy a house right now. I'm a reporter by trade, which means I'm cynical. And I told my parents, look, the housing market's going to collapse, and it's going to collapse really, really bad. And I had other older cousins at the time, not really from my generation, but older cousins who were buying houses, who were buying two or three houses, and I thought it was insane. Here we are about 3 years later. Those cousins of mine lost their homes, lost all of them homes. They had to move back with their children, with their parents, and now my parents are saying, hey, it's time to buy a house. I don't think the housing market, at least in Southern California, I don't think it's bottomed out yet, unless I want to go into the Gomorrah on Earth known as Inland Empire.
Oh, man, yeah, there's some really sad stuff going on there, and unbelievable. But, you know, I think it's also a question, one of the things that you raise is about intent. And what shape do you want your life to take? And very different from generation to generation. We've been hearing a lot about that.
My name's Jose. I'm the first person in my family born in the United States. And it was my parents' dream that I go to college and get a good job. I went to college and I work in an office and every day I'm miserable.
You know, what do you think about that, Gustavo? I mean, so many of us, there's a question of, is the dream to do what you want to do, or is the dream to work your butt off long enough to buy into the dream later? And to me, Jose was really speaking to that.
The dream that my parents had for their children was to come into this country, yeah, work your butt off and make as much money as possible in order to buy yourself security. It wasn't about – for my dad, if I had become a truck driver like him, he would have been happy. I had to push him when I was in high school and say, look, Dad, I don't want to work 18-hour days, six days a week like yourself. I want to get an advanced degree that's going to make my job easier for both myself and also give me a better salary than what you're making. And I was able to achieve that. Of course, I'm a journalist, and we know how great that newspaper industry is nowadays.
Yeah, great move, really Gustavo. Really good call, buddy. Yeah.
Seriously.
Well, you know, one of these questions that what you're writing about, the intergenerational immigrant to second generation transition, it also applies, I think, very much in a cyclical way where, you know, if your parents were struggling, a lot of times there are people I know who are like, you know what, you know, come heck or high water, I'm going to be financially secure. And if your parents are financially secure, sometimes you take risks because you haven't seen the downside. Do you see anything cyclical going on in terms of, you know, people you know?
I certainly hope so, because what I found fascinating, or what I find fascinating about my parents is that my mom was a tomato canner. My dad was a truck driver. And 25 years ago, they were able to scrape their salaries. And they weren't the best of salaries. They were able to scrape their salaries and buy a pretty nice house. And myself, I'm not married, but if I got married with somebody, I'm sure her salary would sort of match my salary. And nevertheless, we wouldn't be able to buy any type of house that even matches to what my parents have. My parents, you know, the house that they have, it's a stucco, you know, it's made of stucco, it's tract housing in Anaheim, California. It's not exactly the best one. So I certainly hope that, we're right down the street from Disneyland, actually. And I hope that my children, that they'll be able to have the same great environment to buy a house that my parents did. I just don't see it for myself in the next couple of years or even decades.
Well, Gustavo, you know you can always move back home. Gustavo Arellano writes the syndicated column, Ask a Mexican.
Well, we're asking all kinds of people this week, what does it mean to have an American dream and what is the new American dream? And this generation, the under 30 crowd, had some pretty negative points of view.
My wife and I are both teachers. We have a 15-month-old son. We have $80,000 of student loan debt. We have a mortgage that's worth $10,000 less than what we currently owe on it. We're living the American dream.
The American dream is dead. And right now, we are, as a country, attending its funeral.
But we've got some optimists under 30 as well.
My American dream is actually just to live and be and try to enjoy life. We want to travel, to stay home with my daughter.
And to work hard, do well, support your family.
To leave a world to my children better than the one that I inherited from mine.
All I really want in the world is to be happy.
The American dream is living in America. Pretty much anything you do is the dream. Me, I'm working my way towards the beach.
All right. The optimists win by my count there. Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. More dreams tomorrow.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.